You are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yeah, say your name.
Oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 7th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's casual Friday, folks. You know what that means? Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Also, this week up, for giving me a movie recommendation for the weekend, which I will undoubtedly not have time to watch, film guy Matthew will be joining us this week. On the program today, following the heels of a revelation of the massive scope and breadth of the NSA / FBI hoovering of metadata, your phone calls, or the metadata of your phone calls, I should say, comes another massive, perhaps even more explosive, revelation of a government program which is surveilling, reading, viewing, logging, almost all of the activity that's taking place on the internet, at least on the major companies, Skype, Microsoft, Apple,
Google, Yahoo,
soon to be Dropbox,
AOL.
I mean, does anybody use AOL anymore? I guess you got to do that for security reasons.
That's for senior terrorists.
Yes, indeed. The burning question, of course, that we have here at the Majority Report is, if the NSA is viewing all of our YouTubes, are we getting ad hits? Are we getting revenue from this? So we just want to say good morning to the NSA. As you know, Casual Fridays, Cliff Schechter will be joining us. Also on the program today, immigration reform. Is it dying? We will ask Cliff Schechter. Also, the grand bargain, is it dead? We will ask Cliff Schechter. Employment numbers are up today, slightly. I wouldn't have a party about it, but it's better than nothing, I guess. Still have a story on that judge who was racist, that atheist who was atheist. Why the Republicans are doing so poorly with young people, and what will happen when they grow up. I'm not referring to the Republicans. I don't think they will grow up. And Mitt Romney weighs in, almost signaling that he is going to launch another campaign to lose the presidency again. But first, ladies and gentlemen, we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to the inimitable Cliff Schechter. The inimitable. I can't walk the streets now to accommodate my mind. A self-pity mama, she starts breaking down. Stop breaking down. Stop breaking down. I'm gonna This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of the Majority Report a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Why not, in light of all these NSA revelations, pick up a free copy of The Shadow Factory, the ultra-secret NSA from 9/11 to the eavesdropping on America by James Bamford. He is the go-to guy on this. Check it out and get it for free at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. It's free. Do it now. Well, it'll make you lose your mind. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, as it is Friday, and God and the NSA declares, so shall it be, Cliff Schechter Day. Hello, Cliff.
Sammy, how are you?
I'm exhausted, Cliff. Oh, good. Wait.
Did you
wait a second? We just got an IM from the NSA. They said we forgot something. Hold on, here it is.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Just one of the benefits that we pay our tax dollars for. The NSA does quality control of the program. If we forget to provide someone's theme song, we get that immediate response. Yes.
It is appreciated. They're very helpful, those guys.
Indeed. So, Cliff, what an amazing week for these revelations. I mean, you know, we should put a little asterisk around them, because these are things that we have known about at least elliptically. On this program, we've had Thomas Drake talking about why he was persecuted by the U.S. government for whistleblowing on the NSA. I think we're seeing now concrete evidence of what Thomas Drake was talking about. And we have talked about how Wyden and Udall, the senators in the House, have been talking about the reauthorization of the Patriot Act and their claims, which were cryptic because they couldn't express them explicitly because of the secret nature of this information, that laws were being used in a way that they did not believe the American public were aware that they were being used. The latest, of course, we had spoken yesterday to Marcy Wheeler about these NSA revelations. Today or last night, we hear about the revelations of almost a much larger program of surveillance of just about, I don't know how to quantify it in terms of all internet traffic in the United States, but 10 of the major sort of portals in which people use the internet being surveilled in real time. Presumably also, you know, anybody watching this on YouTube, for instance, or that Skype call I gave last night to my dad when my son was crying. All of it.
They heard it all, man.
Yeah, it's true. Now, Cliff is being circumspect here, and one must wonder why. No, but I mean, this is, I don't know. Just give me your broad take on this. I mean, I don't even know where to begin.
No, well, that's kind of the tough thing, isn't it? It's sort of, I mean, we all knew this, though. Obviously, we knew with the Patriot Act, which is why a lot of us wanted to get rid of that thing, what was going on in some more generalities. But there's still nothing like having it kind of thrown in your face and knowing the specifics and just how wide a net has been cast. You know, there's knowing and then there's knowing. And when you bring up all the portals, you know, I mean, hell, they were in everything. If you still have a Friendster account, I think they're probably there.
Yeah. No.
I mean, they weren't missing anything. Google, Facebook, you know, it's sort of, you know, Microsoft. I mean, it's amazing in its scope. And, you know, I've seen conflicting reports. I don't know what's fully true yet and what's not, but it seems to me that from everything, it just seems that really the pretty much getting on the list just means actually just showing up there.
Right. I mean,
go ahead.
Well, I mean, the issue here is, I mean, there's a couple of sort of themes that come out of this. One is a theme that we've been talking about quite a bit on this program for the past couple of years, primarily dealing with the national security state. And that is that the excesses of the Bush administration, by excesses, I should rephrase that, the Bush administration was doing things without any statutory authority to do things. They were doing it by virtue of executive power. When Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he spoke out against these. There's a lot of video floating around that people are tweeting and whatnot, purportedly showing President Obama criticizing the same things that he's been engaged in. But if you look at them carefully, you see that he is talking about their illegality or they're operating outside a framework of a statutory framework. What has become clear under the Bush?
As long as you can make them legal, they're cool.
That, I mean, that's basically it, right? I mean, this is I referenced.
Although
this.
I still don't think even if the FISA court granted these wide, for example, this wide latitude to do this, I don't think that's still that may be technically legal at that particular moment, but that doesn't make it constitutional.
Well, that's a secondary issue. Well, maybe it's not secondary, but that's another issue. I mean, let's just start with this notion that clearly what the Obama administration has been trying to do, and Charlie Savage wrote an extended essay on this that we had interviewed him about, I guess, over a year ago now, where he talked about the difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration was that the Obama administration really brought these things into a statutory framework. There's another element of this, which is that much of the interpretation of the statutes, and Noah Feldman wrote a good piece on this in Bloomberg, I think it was today or yesterday, where he says, like, look, we've seen this time and time with the Obama administration, where there is a legal framework for this stuff, but key elements of creating that legal framework are done in secret. So in other words, the FISA court signs off on this. They are simply interpreting a law, and we don't know if they've interpreted the law or there is some question as to whether or not they interpreted the law properly insofar as Congress said you can suck up information that is related to an investigation, but it was so broad that some are arguing that Congress, and this is what I think Wyden and Udall were saying, we passed this statute, but we don't think that people understand how it's being interpreted. And that interpretation is coming from a secret court, which we have no oversight of. So it doesn't really provide a proper check and balance. We saw the same thing with the assassination Tuesdays. We don't know the secret law that supposedly makes the laws that emanate from it. We don't know what that is. And so we have a regime of secret law that is supposedly making all of this stuff kosher. And this is very problematic in and
but
of itself.
You get a few bad judges, you know, who make bad decisions based on that in secret. And let's be honest, we've got some judges. I mean, what if Clarence Thomas is sitting on that court? I mean, hell, Jeff Sessions was a judge before. In fact, he got rejected by Republicans and Democrats when Reagan tried to appoint him, so he did the next best thing and ran for Senate from Alabama. And, of course, the people thought all his racist views were cool. You know who else was a judge? Louis Gohmert was a judge. I mean, so just think about that for a second. And that's the problem here, and I think this connects to the conversation we had, you know, I don't remember if it was a week, 2 weeks, whatever ago, on drones. Because, you know, my response to all that is, you know, that we needed some sort of oversight, but I understand that some of this stuff needs to be done in secret, and so maybe we could have something like a FISA court, but then you get this thrown in your face where the FISA court is essentially acting as an enabler. It doesn't seem to care about people's right to privacy or anything, and so that's the problem with all of this stuff, is finding the balance, because you want there to be oversight of some sort, but if the oversight is always in secret, you know, who is it that gets appointed to these courts? Who is it that are on these bodies, whether they be legislative, judicial, whatever, that are making these decisions? This is difficult stuff, man.
Yeah.
And, you know, and obviously when you look at what just happened, how can you have faith in this?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Verizon or the first revelations of hoovering up this metadata, which presumably is not just Verizon, it's probably all phone companies, and it's not just this 3 month period, it's probably an ongoing thing that gets reauthorized every 3 months or so. The question as to whether or not it bumps up against the Fourth Amendment there is less clear, because there was this case, and I can't, you know, off the top of my head, I can't remember what it was, but it, Maryland v. somebody. And essentially the Supreme Court found that this type of metadata does not bump up against the Fourth Amendment. Now, you can agree or disagree with that ruling of the Supreme Court, and this court certainly is not terribly sensitive to the Fourth Amendment as far as these things go. But,
or really anything that makes any sense.
Right. And so,
as you'll know, Sam, the next time you tie on a few too many, you know, and you're a little bit drunk stumbling down the street, get arrested for public drunkenness, and they grab your DNA.
Indeed. They start to swab my DNA to find out who my relatives are and who else may be publicly drunk at different times. But this PRISM thing seems to go beyond that, because this is actual surveillance. They're actually looking at the content. Now, I don't know if there's individuals sitting in an office somewhere looking at this. Their algorithms look at the content, and then I imagine from there. And the issue with the PRISM thing is that supposedly this stuff has an algorithm that has a 51% chance of identifying whether or not one of the people engaged in the internet communication is from a foreign source. It's a rather dubious claim.
A 51% chance?
Yes, that's basically
like those odds.
That's how they justify this. And so it's. I mean, and then there's another question. There's a blistering New York Times editorial saying, though this may be legal in the context of a legal framework, it shows that there still can be tremendous excesses that if you allow for the discretion of the executive to sort of get into this mix, they're always, the executive, no matter who it is going to take advantage of this, and it's problematic. And the other thing that's sort of fascinating about this, you know, Glenn Greenwald broke both these stories simultaneous with the Washington Post. But from my reading, it seems that Greenwald was the first one to get these documents. And from what I've read, it appears that these two revelations come from the same source. And my guess is, and I should be clear on this, I have no inside information as to this, but my guess is that there was some forethought to providing this information to both the Washington Post, even though the Guardian got it first, Glenn Greenwald got it first, to both outlets, one because one was an American one, one's because it's a British. And also, I think, look, you know, if I'm Glenn Greenwald right now, I know that there is every reason to believe that I am going to be, if not fully surveilled.
I mean, look, I hope he's growing like a handlebar mustache right now, you know, maybe shaving his head, finding some new patterns of behavior. Because I know Glenn from way back. I haven't seen Glenn in a while, but I know him, and I'd be nervous.
Oh yes, and you know there was a piece, about him in the New York Times, which was one of those, I don't know, they were trying to make him seem like some type of alien being who can't keep friends, and I don't know, was half in his PJs all the time.
But the one that came out was like Blogger Glenn Greene, that
yes,
whole thing,
yes,
the one that was
yes.
out the other day.
Yes, and
it was funny. I know
it's pretty stunning. But now we should just say there's some breaking news. President Obama has stated this on PRISM. This does not apply to U.S. citizens, and it does not apply to people living in the United States. Now, the definition of that, again, is from what we understand that there's a 51%.
Always look beneath the words.
Right. There's a 51% chance that this does not apply to the U.S.
Well,
citizens.
Right. First of all, they can screw up, and luckily we know from drone strikes going awry and whole nations invaded that didn't actually do anything to attack us, that we never make mistakes on that level. So I feel pretty good that 51% will come through.
Now,
meaning that we've never screwed anything big up. Right, so that's good.
Now, he qualified that with saying you can't have 100% security and 100% privacy. And
you try to find a little bit of a better balance than this.
Well, that's exactly the point. Right?
I mean, and somebody excoriated me for this, but I'm just going to say this, and maybe you'll find this crass because you're from the area at least. But the Boston thing still happened, you know. And to me, if the whole this is immoral to begin with, so I wouldn't really care if it prevented things, because you do have to find the right balance. And obviously, in an age of you know, where there can be, you know, nuclear suitcases and there can be you know, chemical weapons, and ricin can be sent through the mail. There are some people who I don't realize don't think that things have been stopped, and this is a real threat. And as much as we've kept the terrorism count, and particularly in this country, low, all it takes is them getting through one time with something with a weapon of mass destruction, which now can happen, and they fit in a suitcase. But at the same time, you do have to balance that with the fact that there's a right to privacy, and for people just walking around innocently being tagged and watched and listened to is ridiculous if we're going to continue to call ourselves a democracy. So where's that middle ground? And so to me, this program's immoral. But again, let's go back to it. If this dragnet they're sweeping everybody up in, if they're watching us online and they're recording our phone calls, then really shouldn't there be a 100% success rate? I mean, the fact that something like what happened in Boston could happen, or what almost happened in Spokane, where there is a IED left next to a Martin Luther King Day march that just happened to be discovered by somebody walking by, there obviously are things that are still happening. So apparently, we never can be fully safe. Right.
Yeah, but I mean, look,
that makes this even that much more ridiculous.
Right. I mean, but we can't be safe from anything. And
that's
and,
right.
You know,
that's what I'm trying to say here.
When we're talking about existential threats, when we're talking about threats on a mass level, but you know, the Boston Marathon bombers could have been much worse theoretically. I mean, these guys could have continued on with what they were doing and had continually terrorizing the city. But the fact is, we're not talking about existential threats here. It's not like we haven't had periods of our history where people have been bombing things. We also have no ability to sort of judge the efficacy of this. I mean, we know that guys like the NSA whistleblowers, the four or five of these guys, were in many respects blowing the whistle not just on this incredible invasion of our privacy, but also on the efficacy of the approach that the NSA was taking. You have all this data, it becomes that much harder if you do not target to actually find the things
that you need
to find.
That's a great point. You got too much crap lying around. It's like for anybody who's ever done a research paper before or anything else. I mean, an overwhelming amount of material makes it less effective. Less is more. Maybe they should put them up on the walls at the NSA.
And you know, as we did an interview with Tim Shorrock, who who had dug deeply into these whistleblowers. And a couple of these whistleblowers were saying that prior to 9/11, we had a system that was far more targeted and far more effective. And then we outsourced this, which was basically just a huge corporate boondoggle. And so we don't know.
I mean, like the idea of outsourcing that stuff to corporations,
well,
too. And I find they always act in our best interest, so that's helpful.
We're going to talk about this in the better half of the program, but there is some the internet companies that have been sort of noted in this PowerPoint presentation that was leaked to Glenn Greenwald that discusses PRISM. They have all denied that they have been working with the government or providing the government with access to their servers. Now, there's a couple of different ways that you can interpret those denials. One, you can simply say that that's what they believe to be the case. Two, you could say that there is definitely that there is very possibly. And we know that they received immunity under the amended FISA Act, that there's a possibility that their liability, their lack of liability is tied into their having to deny at all times whether or not they are involved in this. Or you could parse their denials and say maybe they're not allowing the government to do this. Maybe it's contracted out to another company. There's been some speculation as to who that company might be. We will talk about this in the better half of the program. But so we just don't know the nature of these things, and we don't know the scope of these programs. We don't know the legal justification for these programs insofar as how it's being interpreted by the government. We don't know why these things are kept so secret, because in many respects, surely we have talked about in the past that there's an expectation, or at least there's an awareness, that the NSA has been involved in this type of stuff, because we've talked to whistleblowers and reporters who have talked about it. I don't know if there's a broad awareness of this, but certainly if we're talking about it, there must be some awareness by those terrorists who supposedly want to do us harm, particularly on the scale that we're talking about and the level of sophistication we're talking about, that that's going on. So why does that program have to be so secret? All of these are questions that are just hanging in the air right now. Do you think that people are going to make – I mean, it's a big deal for people like us.
Well, and people obviously have in the history of this country in many different iterations abused this kind of authority. It's not like we don't have a history, you know, like most countries, of Alien Sedition Acts, Palmer Raids, J. Edgar Hoover. And so, I mean, to act like people should have no concerns, you know, the classic sort of Lindsey Graham comment, if you're not a terrorist, you have nothing to worry about.
Right.
Which, by the way, I find really funny that Lindsey Graham, because he's not hiding anything. I'm sure they wouldn't discover anything in his phone calls.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got nothing that he's hiding.
Nothing
no skeletons in his
Lindsey.
Closet, so to speak.
Right. I mean, sometimes he has to take a call in the closet. He'll walk out of the closet sometimes to answer the phone, too. But I'm sure they won't discover anything with him. In any case,
he uses Sprint for those phone calls.
Yes, he certainly does. Or, well, I won't even go on with this. But, I mean, common sense tells you that this stuff can be abused. And history tells you it always is. So, I mean, to think that people that have no connection to you, people far away in some, you know, center somewhere who don't know you, have no connection to your life, wouldn't necessarily take information. I mean, we're in that age right now where you go somewhere in a day and you use your credit card a bunch of places, and obviously suddenly you find your card being charged because somebody stole a number. And there's sort of security issues for all of us that we have to deal with, that there's just no choice in modern society. But there's other things that we shouldn't be exposed to and shouldn't have to deal with. And this just opens up a can of worms and creates such the possibility of abuse that the simplistic answers of, oh, don't worry, if you're not doing anything wrong, you'll be fine. I mean, anybody can say that is just ignorant. I think often on purpose. And blissfully ignorant and chooses to be.
And the point is that our Fourth Amendment basically says you cannot be investigated, you cannot be searched. unless there's some type of reasonable suspicion. And what we have right here is clearly there is no target to this search. This is basically just – this is, you know, in some respects, it's
– this is the equivalent of cops just walking
pre-crime
door to door and knocking on your door, coming into your house and looking for wrongdoing.
I mean, it's – right. And it's and – I don't know. It's maybe it's a stop and frisk on some level.
I think in a lot of ways it is stop and frisk, yes.
So I don't know. It's troublesome. Well, obviously, we're going to talk more about this on this program going forward. Like I say, in the better half, we'll talk about this story that,
You know, what I find really exhausting is how much clearer I have to enunciate now to make sure the NSA understands me when I'm talking to you on the phone.
Well, I look, there's a couple of things that I think, you know, that that the Obama administration could do to turn this thing around from a PR standpoint. One is start monetizing all that stuff that they're looking at, because if everybody gets, you know, an extra couple of clicks, this could be a good stimulus for the economy.
Give me a piece of the action. That's exactly right.
And then the flip side of that also is, you know, imagine the company the NSA could set up in terms of geo-targeting advertising online. They've got all the data. So
that's a great point, too.
Maybe we could pay the NSA to provide us with our computer backups.
Exactly. Their new cloud storage.
Think of the money they could get paid by, like, a TMZ or Politico. I mean, like the phone conversations of Mark Sanford.
Indeed. There
you know
go.
What I mean? So, like, that's got to be good stuff, right? The home computer self-picks of Anthony Weiner.
Michael.
I mean, I'm not saying I'm interested in that, but there may be some people out there who for some reason, find that strangely off-putting or compelling enough, kind of like a car crash that you can't look away from.
Yes,
I'm just saying, you know, they can monetize this thing. They're smart people over there, theoretically.
Yesterday, the NSA, on their NSA Careers Twitter, put out they're looking for a digital network exploitation analyst development. What is this now? You've entered a secured site. Data you enter on the site is protected in transit. Oh, okay. Whatever you tell me, buddy. That's funny. They're looking for analysts right now. We need and maybe PR people as well.
Oh, I'm in, man.
This was pretty funny.
You know, basically, I think the best thing you can do to figure out if the NSA is listening is you just start off every conversation from now on the phone, and really end every conversation, you just go, NSA, yes, I'll say what? And if somebody says what from out there, you're in. You know they're there. That's what I'm doing anyhow.
This is from the head of the NSA, General Alexander, I guess at some cyber security conference. It is, quote, I'm an advocate of the cloud in terms of securing your material. I bet. Let's move on. We're obviously going to talk about this more, but let's move on for a moment. And you know, just I want to reiterate, you know, it's good for Glenn Greenwald. He knows he's walking into a crap storm here. And
I don't always agree with Glenn. And I think personally, I think there's some histrionics sometimes in what he does. But that's my personal opinion. I also think that he does a lot of good because he's willing to talk about things and go places other people won't. And this is one of those examples. Where, you know, you need people who are willing to take these kinds of risks, because otherwise you never hear about stuff like this. So good for Glenn. And then seriously, I mean, I hope he's okay. Yeah. I don't know what else to say. He's a man with more courage than I have.
Let's move on. Let's move on here because we don't have too much time.
Okay.
I wanted, you know, immigration is it looks as bleak for immigration reform as it has in months, I think. But before we get there, let's talk about this grand bargain. The Center for American Progress came out this week, basically did a huge pivot, said we no longer should be concentrating on deficit reduction. We no longer support a grand bargain with the Republicans that is focused on deficit reduction. lagging indicator, these guys, or what?
I'd say so. But it just reminds me how amazing this whole thing is, how, like, and I would say we get group hypnotized. I think a lot of people around the country don't pay close attention to, because they just hear what they hear. But obviously it's not hypnotism, it's self-interest from people in certain parts of the media, you know, the self-styled centrist crowd. Who pushes this? It just reminds you again, like, we hear this, if you've been alive long enough, you can remember Ross Perot, and you can remember, I mean, we have this, literally this hissy fit every sort of however many years that we're on the precipice and everything's going to end. And, you know, never, always it's during a recession when these kinds of things are going on. And as we all know, had the stimulus been bigger, we would have recovered much quicker, and economic growth is the best thing because tax revenues then come in higher. I mean, this is simple common sense stuff that you can pump out as much garbage about supply side economics as you want. Doesn't work, has never worked, never will work. And we knew that. This was always the answer to any of these problems. Create economic growth and this problem solves itself. People go back to work. You know, it's better in every way. It's better for the deficit. It's better on an individual level, both a macro and microeconomic level. And so here we are again. And, you know, I'm glad Cap is along on this. And I'm glad that I've heard others who are now saying this. But it's just amazing to me that we just went through this whole sort of matrix-like experience again, where for a year or however long, people were just hypnotized. Oh, my God, we have to do something about the deficit, and the debt's never going to come down. When, of course, again, it's like you have to willfully ignore the entire history of this country.
It's
maddening how much time we wasted on this crap.
And it really is. We should say that the employment numbers that came out this week – the U.S. economy added 175,000 jobs, which was, I think, just slightly bigger than expectation.
Yeah, 165 is what I think they had projected.
This is by no means where we need to be. We really need to be closer to the 250,000 added jobs a month, maybe more, actually. But, I mean, you know, on this pace, we're about 4 years, 5 years out from getting back to some type of, like, reasonable employment level. The unemployment rate ticked up to 7.6%, which is actually, people say, is a sign that at least people are re-entering the job market.
That's exactly right.
And looking for jobs.
People are back to looking for jobs. So that's I know it seems kind of weird and counterintuitive, but that's actually a good thing.
And the other element of this that we got to keep in mind is the federal government employment declined by 14,000 in May. Over the past 3 months, it's decreased by 45,000. This is obviously a function of the sequester and other cuts. And so we would have far better job growth at this point were it not for government shutting jobs. It's just one more example of
right. –
and it's only going to get worse with the sequester.
Another important point on that is that for the first time, if I'm correct, we just had a period of net growth in government, in state government jobs. And I remember the big thing that was for lack of a better word, terrible in terms of how it undercut the stimulus is when the president listened to the Maine sisters and Arlen Specter and cut a lot of the state funding out.
Yep.
So all of these states were required to balance their budgets by law, had to end up cutting all sorts of jobs to do it. And it counteracted a lot of what the stimulus was supposed to do. It was just idiotic. And so now for the first time, I think it was 14,000 net jobs that states went up by, something like that, which means the states are now starting to rehire people again, which will – so that it won't be as much – not all of them, and I'm sure it's different in different states, but at least that's somewhat of a positive outlook too.
Yeah, and we'll see. I mean, because I think as sequester takes even more hold, it's going to be even more problematic going forward. We see a little uptick in mortgage rates, and that could, at least in certain areas of the country, people are reporting, it could cause some of those sort of the corporate behemoths that have been buying up a lot of these properties to back off their buying, and sort of they were somewhat artificially perhaps creating more value in real estate. We'll have to see how these things turn out. But let's we've got just a couple of minutes. Let's turn briefly to immigration. Now, this is sort of it's fascinating what's happening here, because you and I have speculated or have talked about this in the past, that the Republican Party writ large, to the extent that there is any brain, okay, that is the Republican Party, any sort of cohesive Republican Party, they would know that if they stand in the way of immigration reform, they are poised to lose a generation, if not more, of Latino and, in many respects, Asian American voters. These are two very fast-growing demographic groups. Are two groups that they are in not high esteem with, particularly Latinos, because so much of the anti-immigration rhetoric is in the form of brown people bashing. But what we're seeing here, because Rubio has been sort of back and forth as to whether or not he's going to support his own bill. What we're seeing here, particularly after the Steve King's bill to repeal the Executive Order DREAM Act got 221 votes from Republicans, what we see here is basically that divide between the national aspirations of Republicans and the reality for Republicans in their home districts, which is that they have the red meat eaters in their districts because of redistricting and other factors, and they don't.
And the Senate is a huge part of this problem, and will continue to be, because there's nothing we can do about it, which is the fact that every state gets two senators, and there's just certain people from places like Wyoming and Alabama who send the craziest loons to the U.S. Senate, who, if they're not planning on running for president, the Hispanic thing is not their problem. They just don't care. And they make up such a solid block. All you need is people from 15 states with those feelings, right? Oklahoma, Utah, if you get up there and you've got 30 senators and you're heading towards, being that we need 60 votes, you're really not far off from blocking anything at that point.
Now, the interesting thing is that a lot of people have been writing about the dynamic where there are people who, conservatives, who cannot afford to vote for immigration reform because they'll take a beating at home with their Republican base, but still want it to pass because they know that this is going to be a drag in future elections in some respect. And so they don't want to they want to be able to come. They want their cake and eat it, too, essentially. And so there's a lot of backroom dealing going on here. And I think, what's clear is if immigration reform passes, it's going to pass through the Senate with a minimum number of Republican votes, like you say, just to get past that 60-vote threshold. And then I would imagine in the House, it's going to pass with a vast majority of Democratic votes. And we're going to see the Hassert rule broken again, which, is...
It'll have to be for it to pass, obviously, in the House. Yeah, it's... Again, if it's going to pass, but you're right. I mean, you've got Rubio talking about voting against his own bill. You've got in the House Raul Labrador from Idaho, I believe it is, who, not shockingly, has walked away from the gang that they formed. They have to form gangs all the time on these things. And every single time they form a gang, they negotiate for a while, and the Republicans in that gang walk away. It happened in healthcare with Grassley and Enzi. It happened on guns with Coburn. It's amazing. When do these guys get to the point where Lucy isn't pulling the football away anymore, and they kind of realize that this is the way it goes?
That's going to be in a couple of
these
generations.
These guys come and they so-called negotiate, and then they just. I'm not saying all of them. There's a few maybe there in good faith here and there. Toomey was on guns, and it seems like on immigration, potentially McCain and Flake and a few others. But in the end, most of these guys end up walking away, and you just waste your time negotiating with them. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see where this heads. All right, well, we didn't have a chance to get to that the story of the Republican problems with the youth.
We can sum it up.
Yeah.
The old, white, fat, racist, fundamentalist, stupid, ignorant, They like corn dogs way too much, and that just doesn't appeal to the rest of us.
Right, and to be fair, Eric Erickson is probably middle aged at this point. So
that's true. He's only a middle aged, fat, white, Southern guy who thinks women should be subservient to him. That's true. So he's 10 years younger than the average base. Otherwise, he's pretty solidly there.
Hard to imagine why this isn't going over with the youth in this country.
And I have one last question: who names their kid Eric Erickson? I mean, were his parents stoned at the time?
You cannot get past that.
I think we deserve an answer to that question of, if your parents were the least creative naming people in the world, maybe you were always doomed.
I don't know. It's a hook. It served them well.
I think the fat Southern white guy served him well, quite frankly. That's gotten him through the Rush Limbaugh type circles to where he needs to be. I don't know.
Great psychotherapist, though, Cliff.
I'm sorry?
There was a great therapist, though, Eric Erickson, Cliff.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good point.
So they didn't screw up that.
You just got hammered, my man.
Oh, I didn't mean it like that.
All right, Brooks, don't you try and call me again, you punk.
Oh!
I kid. Well played, buddy.
All right.
I'm still sticking with my criticism of Eric Erickson. I don't care.
Cliff Schechter, everybody. Cliff, we are now only, I think we got one more Friday, and then we're going to be in San Jose together.
In sunny San Jose, that's right.
I'm getting psyched up for that.
That's going to be a good time, definitely. Yes, so we'll have one more of these, and I guess we'll do one of these from there.
Yes, sir, we will indeed. All right, Cliff Schechter, folks. Thanks so much, Cliff.
Hey, thanks, buddy. Bye. Thanks, guys.
All right. Oh, and then he walks out of the room, apparently. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matthew Film Guy, and then later in the program, we have another potential hit song from Jimmy Reefer Cake. And we will be taking your phone calls, 646-257-3920. All that and more in just a brief moment. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Sadly, because of technical difficulties we've had this week, we do not have Matthew Film Guy's theme song, but I'll just use this instead. Yes, it's Matthew Film Guy here to tell us this week's film selections. Matthew Film Guy, welcome to the program.
Why, thank you, Samuel.
Ah, well done, well done.
A pleasure to be here.
I want to congratulate you. Last night, as Nikki and I do, after we've put the children to bed for the fourth time, we get in front of each of our respective computers, and then we would occasionally touch base with each other over the course of the night, and she started laughing, and I immediately asked her what was wrong, and went over there, and she was watching a video that you made on that you posted on Facebook, apparently. A parody, and we got to be careful. I don't want to get into any spoil alerts, but it was
right.
A parody of a video that was made by an actor in the or actress in the Game of Thrones. So I just wanted to give you a little kudos on that.
Oh, thank you very much, Sam. That was I was inspired by Maisie Williams, who plays Aria. She made a video on Vine, you know, the new Twitter video kind of platform that stuck in my head, and I made a little tribute to it. It was her reaction to the shocking events of last week's episode, which, no spoilers.
Right, there you go.
But it was pretty intense.
We managed to do that pretty well, actually, avoid those spoilers. Now, last week, not last week, but a month ago, I guess. Wow, has it been that long? You recommended that I watch Let the Right One In and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And
right.
I watched Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, although I watched that... when
and
it first
you'd
came
already
out.
Seen it.
I had already seen it. I also noticed that Michael, who gave me the list of this, I don't know if you copied it right from the website, Michael, but...
of course I did.
Okay, well, in that case, you should go back and fix the way you spelled Taylor. Michael does not know how to spell. So just as an
you know,
FYI...
Nobody's perfect.
Yes, just as a public service, Taylor is not spelled T-A-Y-L-O-R, unless you're talking about someone's last name who happens to be Taylor, spelt that way.
Right, I think, yeah. That's, Jonathan Taylor Thomas Spy.
Right, yes, I think that's... he did, however, spell, as far as I can tell, Let the Right One In, and I did not watch that. Now, let me tell you something. My kid is 3 months old today... And
congratulations. That's a cute picture of him on the website, by the way.
Yes. We have a picture of Saul on the website. I was going to try and tweet it, but I haven't hooked up my Twitter to my photo thing, apparently, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So
he'll forgive you someday.
He might. He might.
Along with everything else, I'll just lump that in.
And he is just a bundle of joy, but doesn't sleep that well. So I'm exhausted and... You know, we never get a chance to watch anything anymore. But
I understand. I understand. And, you know, I kept that in mind with this week's recommendation. It's not really for you anymore. It's more just for the general audience out there.
Well, that's always been also, you know, part of this. This isn't just for me.
Yeah.
The whole show
was
is
fun
for me.
Game to play for a while, trying to figure out what you'd like. But you know, that's gone now.
Oh well. All right. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm in some way.
No, not at all. It's easier. I ran out of. Semi-intelligent action movies to recommend. You know, there's just only so many out there.
Well, you only gave me like three.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, you've seen a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean...
did you ever watch Drive, by the way? Because Drive is up there.
Oh, I have not watched that yet, but maybe we should just play this music slightly in the background as you tell us about the non-intelligent action films.
Have you seen the work of Michael Bay? Transformers 1, 2, and 3.
Are you impressed with how much President Obama has come out against patent trolls since he got word that the Majority Report was under attack from patent trolls?
How much the president has? Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I was impressed.
In fact,
with
it's really it's turned around my entire opinion of the man.
Well, I know, I mean, I have to say that I'm looking at this a little bit jaundicedly. I know that the agenda behind him coming out against patent trolls at a time when we are under attack from patent trolls is for me to go a little soft on him.
He's clearly currying favor with you and your podcast. I agree.
Indeed. Indeed.
But, you know, that's politics. You know, if you can't, you know, grease the wheels a little bit when you need to, what good is it? You know, so
it's all transactional, isn't it?
Yeah, it's transactional.
So just a Matthew Film Guy, just in general, tell us what you've been up to briefly before you give us a movie suggestion.
What have I been up to? Well, that feature film that I told you about that I edited, Detonator, that had its premiere in the Brooklyn Film Festival last week, and that went over very well.
I
taught a workshop at the New School to filmmaking class there, so... spreading the word of film and basically film production on that end. And I'm editing a comedy web series right now, which has been pretty good.
What is the web series?
It's called 86. It's about waiters working, you know, actors who are waiters working in New York City. And it's sort of improv-based, as you may have heard people do that sometimes.
Nope.
and it's looking pretty funny. I'm just getting into the footage, so I'll keep you posted.
Any names in that we might recognize, or no? Is this one of those more?
No, it's people who've been in plenty of productions throughout the New York comedy scene, and you know, the kind of the improv world, but nobody I'd think that would jump out at you right away yet.
Yes, well, I'm out of that scene for all intents and purposes now, so it's hard for me to keep
track.
Well,
you made that scene, and you got out, you know.
That's
so what
right.
Can you do?
I built
the improv
it,
comedy,
and then
scene.
I gave
they,
it
they
over to the
history,
kids.
They know my history, so I'm sure that had something to do with it.
I built it, and I gave it over to the kids. All right, so, Matthew, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, so this week I wanted to recommend a movie that I just rewatched. It's really one of my favorite movies, and it's by one of my favorite directors, Elaine May, who, again, speaking of improv, she was one of the progenitors of the live improv genre with, of course, her partner, Mike Nichols.
Now, I got to say,
I have a
video. A buddy of mine was working on a retrospective of theirs a long time ago, and I got a video of just an amazing bit they did at, I think it was the Emmys, like 50 years ago now, probably 40 years ago.
I've heard of that one.
Where they come up, where Nichols comes up and gives an award for the most mediocre television producer.
Yes. It's amazing how sort of ahead of their times they were with
so
that kind
of
like, social commentary through their improv, like, you know, digging at the industry function.
Their stuff is some of my favorite stuff because they were doing satire. They were really crapping on their own peeps, and I have a lot of respect for that.
They managed to make
it work for them, whereas when I did that, it just managed to alienate people. But
I don't know. They just had that they were endearing in some way that I wouldn't say you're not, but they just had a kind of charisma which I wouldn't say you don't have. But they had other elements that made the snarkiness kind of go down
like
easy,
what?
I guess.
I mean, so if I have the same amount of
charisma
as Nichols
right.
and May and charm as Nichols and May, what is it that I lack?
I can only suggest that they've just beat you to the well. You know, that's really all I can say is they came first.
All right, fair enough.
It must be.
So
there's no other explanation I can think of.
First, there's a bar to entry for anybody who comes in after them. Okay, fair
that's
enough.
Right, that's right. That must be it.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it is.
I'm positive.
All right, so what do you got for us?
So she moved from doing nightclub comedy and improv comedy live to making feature films, and she made one of my all-time favorite films called Mikey and Nikki, which is not really available on streaming, but her first comedy, which I just rewatched, because it was actually just re-released on Blu-ray, was called A New Leaf, starring Elaine May and... why am I blanking on his name now? Walter Matthau.
Oh.
And Walter Matthau plays an aging bon vivant, a kind of a member of the luxury class, a trust funder who's never worked a day in his life and whose only interest in life, he says in the film, is just to be rich and drive his Ferraris and go to the polo club. And he wakes up one day to discover that his trust fund has run out after he's lived beyond his means for many years. And he decides that in, classic screwball comedy kind of way that he can only get out of this by marrying for money. And he goes looking for a rich person to marry and to scheme and to possibly murder for her money.
Wow.
And that turns out to be Elaine May. And it is just a scathingly, satirically hilarious comedy about the sort of idle rich. But at the same time, it has this thing, which maybe this is a key to the difference between you and Elaine May. I don't want to project, but that there's an empathy also for this tool, this guy who's just completely cut off from being able to deal with real people and, sniffs at the wrong kind of wine and he has to have his ascot on and his smoking jacket and all these kind of things that keep him apart from life and make him basically a prisoner of his own sort of luxury. And it's really touching.
I don't have that type of empathy for my – I often don't have that type of empathy for the characters that I wrote in the past.
You know, in a way you do, but this is like, I don't know, it's moving in a way that, actually, I'll just to draw a parallel to your films, which you're trying to do, is the end of Pilot Season, that scene between you and Sarah is like what this, through and through, this movie is, where you think it's one thing, turns out to be another, but it's actually really touching.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give too much away about either thing, but I suggest everybody go out and watch this movie. If you can get it on Blu-ray, it's even better, but it is streaming on Amazon. And,
why is it better on Blu-ray?
It's great. Yeah, it's better on Blu-ray.
Why?
And this movie also went through
a
lot of
recuts. Why is it better on Blu-ray than streaming on Amazon?
The version that's streaming on Amazon is the old 4x3, not widescreen, transfer.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that cinematically speaking, you prefer to watch the comedies in their full 16x9.
Yeah, cue the music, please. 4x3 eliminates at least one third of the image intended by the director.
Hallelujah.
That is all.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
But also the transfer quality is a little bit better. But it's a comedy, so you really aren't going to lose that much. So
thank you.
If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can stream it for free.
Bingo.
Yeah.
That's how much I want to pay.
Yeah.
Free.
Yeah, that's right in your budget.
Exactly. Well, Sir Matthew Weiss, Sir Matthew Film Guy.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time today. I know that you have a very busy schedule, and you must trot off to the polo grounds, but I thank you for spending this moment for us and sharing your wit and wisdom about film, and you may continue on. You've certainly earned that glass of sherry I know you're drinking right now.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Not at all, though. Not at all.
All right. Matthew Film Guy, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Same here, Sam. Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, let's play the Jimmy Reefer Cake Song of the Week, and then we will go into the better half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. If you want the full program, or if you want to just make sure that this program continues, please become a member today at majority.fm. You can become a member for literally pennies a day. Well, not pennies. I mean, 33 pennies a day. So, you know, I notice, you know, Greenwald maintains, I don't know if I mentioned this yesterday, and if a caller, I should tell you, if you're calling in, we're going to take calls in about 5 minutes, 3 minutes maybe even. Greenwald set up a deal. Did I mention this the other day? That he has a deal with The Guardian where he still solicits donations for his writing. Partially supported by The Guardian and partially supported by readers. And he does that so that he can maintain full independence. One of the things that came out in this is he was contemplating writing this piece not for The Guardian, to push the issue of journalists who are not affiliated with a big publication. And instead, I think he ultimately decided that the legal protections, the editorial protections, and the platform of presenting this to The Guardian outweighed sort of his own agenda to try and push the limits of what the U.S. government will do in terms of prosecuting leaks. But the point remains that this is the model for independent journalism going forward. I, in no way, am trying to say that what we do here is at the level of import as to what Glenn Greenwald does. But I do think within the context of that ecosystem, we play an important part. Glenn Greenwald has been a frequent guest on this program, perhaps more so than any program. I'm not convinced that back in the day, we weren't the first person to put him on mass media back in 2005, just when he started blogging. In fact, I'd be surprised if we weren't the first. And so, you know, that's all part of disseminating this stuff. So your support allows us to do that in a way that is uninhibited by financial constraints that are put on by donors and by you know, sponsors and whatnot. So if you can become a member, please do so at majority.fm. You can also support this show through our Amazon link and buying justcoffee.coop. fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% coupon code majority. Here is the Jimmy Reefer Cake song.
Whoops.
That is not the Jimmy Reefer Cake song.
My bad. All right, now here is the Jimmy Reefer Cake song.
Okay.
It is called Nothing Gets Done.
Nothing Gets Done.
Ain't it funny how they all say they're in this for everyone? But in the end, surprisingly, nothing gets done. Nothing gets done. Look at all these politicians from the left, right, north, and south. Every one of them is pointing a finger. Every one of them is flapping their mouth. Bow, bow, da-da-da, flap, flap.
All these freaking politicians, flap, man. Flap, I wonder if they ever heard the old saying. You know how it goes, man. Action speaks louder than words. The EPA legalized pollution to get to the underground gas. But they still consider weed a Schedule 1 drug.
Kiss my ass. Ridiculous thing. I put aside your arrogance. Listen here, son, or I guarantee to you, in the end, nothing gets done.
Well,
to see the disconnect, how could you trust the feds? They can't keep the groundwater clean, 'cause they'd rather control our heads.
Well, hello, Jimmy Reefer Creek. A lot of cynicism there. Not sure I subscribe to that. Of course, if I did, I guess I wouldn't do this show. Things get done, and sometimes there are things we don't like. And there are periods where our government is more functional than others. So don't lose hope, Jimmy Reefer Cake. Do not lose hope. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, your phone call, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. We will take phone calls when we get back in just a moment after this brief, musical interlude.